The following is Kel Smith's talk, What We Can Learn from Digital Outcasts, from the 2013 Information Architecture Summit. The 2013 IA Summit podcasts are brought to you by User Interface Engineering. Stay tuned after the podcast for a special offer from UIE.
Thank you, Dave. Very kind. I am really nothing special, however. My grandmother is spectacular. This is her. She is 99 years old, and about 10 years ago, at the age of 89, while living in Florida, she had the opportunity to meet a famous rock star by the name of Vincent Furnier, who you may know better as Alice Cooper. This is not a joke. This really happened. My grandmother, the retired elementary school teacher from Camp Hill, Pennsylvania, Gladys Burns, had lunch and played a round of golf with Alice Cooper, or Vincent, as he prefers to be called. And apparently this is what he does. He spends time flying around in his world tours. He stops in places. Huge golf fanatic, loves playing golf, loves meeting people. And one day, my grandmother was a lucky one. And they played golf, and they had lunch. And I said, what are you talking about? You know, but they have more in common than their love of golf. They are also members of the fastest growing age demographic in the world, people over the age of 65. I'm going to show you some numbers here, all right? And I like numbers. People sometimes accuse me of getting too buried into the numbers. I like numbers, though, because I think you can find a story sometimes by looking at it. So let me first describe what you're looking at here. That y-axis, the vertical, is life expectancy, okay? It starts at about, say, 40 years and goes up to 90. So the higher up we go, the longer people are living. The x-axis is how many of those years can be expected to be spent without a disability, reasonably healthy, right? Starting with about 79% healthy years to about 89% healthy, okay? Now, the Global Burden of Disease Commission did a study in 1990 on this, and the Washington Post had an article about it last fall. And they profiled 240 industrialized countries all around the world to see where they plotted on this graph. In 1990, it looked like this, okay? And those different colors denote different continents. So if you look at this, you sort of interpret it like, all right, so in 1990, I could expect to live, say, between 50 and 80 years and have maybe 81 to 87 or so percent of that somewhat free of disability. Okay? That makes sense. Now, fast forward 20 years to 2010, the graph looked like this. It flattened out. More countries moved to the top. More countries moved to the left. Right? And what that tells us is that people are living longer, but they may not necessarily be living healthier or without disability. And the likelihood of our getting a disability as we get older increases over time, right? And in case you're wondering, the U.S. is right there. Okay? That blue dot in the bottom is Haiti, and the dot all the way to the right is China. And I think about this a lot because I spend a lot of my time and my thinking in that weird intersection between healthcare and disability and UX and design and product development and technology. And I think, how come we haven't quite solved that problem all the way? I don't know yet. And you'd think that science would get us there. As an example, last summer, this dude gets in a metal hut, right? And he goes up, 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 up into the sky, 21 miles in the sky, almost to outer space, right? Not quite, but almost. Opens the door, because, you know, why not? Waves at whatever, whomever's up there, yells at Geronimo, and goes down, 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 into the ground, gets up, walks away, says, gee, that was fun. So we can do that, technologically speaking. We're able to do that. And yet CAPTCHA for blind people is this big mystery. We have no way of making accessible CAPTCHAs. We try. We have audio CAPTCHAs, and we have these kind of CAPTCHAs, and we put those little like weird forms and things. But we haven't yet found that one that's 100% hand-in-glove accessible, right? There are people, and I swear I talked to somebody maybe 48 hours ago, who still believe that if you make an accessible web property, you're somehow depreciating other aspects, the creative aspects, the functional aspects. It's a lower end product, it's the lowest common denominator you hear a lot. And there are people who believe that as you increase accessibility, you're depreciating other values. People still believe this. If you have a disability in this country, you are 27% less likely to have access to broadband internet. And just this morning, as I was watching the keynote this morning, it was interesting, I saw a tweet by my friend Victor who said, I'm looking forward to the day when I'm able to feel toolbars and buttons on a tablet with my fingers. Victor is blind. He wants to be able to resize, expand, squeeze, all that stuff, just like everyone else. So as we're in a discussion talking about this, I was thinking about Victor and a tweet which came in, I mean, just this morning. It was amazing. Now, this word innovation gets thrown around a lot, and I have had job titles with the word innovation in it, which is really hilarious. I just find that really amusing to myself. Now, 3 years ago this week, the iPad came out, right? Remember that? It was a long time ago, right? Three versions, four versions, right? And people said, this is innovation, this 5x8 piece of glass. And it always comes down to a device, right? This is innovation, this is going to solve this, this is going to solve that, right? And I tend to look for my innovation in other sources. I'm really intrigued by what happens in Manila. In some slum areas of Manila, people live in near darkness 24 hours a day for 3 months in a row in monsoon season. They live in corrugated tin huts with no electricity, and you can't put a fire because the whole village would burn down, quite literally. So how do you solve the problem of bringing light into these areas if you can't have electricity and you can't make a fire? So what they did was they put chlorinated water in plastic bottles and slammed them into holes in the roof, creating the equivalent of 55 watts of light, right? And it's a group called My Shelter Foundation, and these are now in 10,000 homes in these neighborhoods. I like that approach to innovation. I like the idea of sort of going around and finding things around and kind of making the best of what you already have. I like that sort of sustainable way of doing things. And Thomas Armstrong wrote a great book called Neurodiversity, which I really recommend if I could say it. So neurodiversity. And he wrote a blog post about the importance of disability with respect to the neuroecosystem, right? And he equated it to being in a forest and sort of like going through, you know, it's dark and it's dirty and it's organic and there's sticks and there's trees and there's water and things all over the place. And out of this seeming chaos of stuff, a bird builds a nest out of things that it finds in order to sustain and ensure that it's going to live another day. And it's called niche construction. That's the kind of the term for it. And this happens in biology all the time. And if you look at a nest sometime, you'll see, you know, rolled up newspapers and gum wrappers and sticks and leaves. But out of all of that, it's ensuring that it's going to preserve its survival, right, for another day at least, or at least another generation. And what's fascinating is that in the technology sphere, people with disabilities and people on behalf of people with disabilities are doing this all the time. They're going through and ripping apart things and making and remaking and, you know, all this stuff and coming up with really interesting products that may or may not enter the commercial sector but are helping that one person get along better in life. And there's some great, great design modalities and lessons we can take from this. So with your indulgence, I'm going to talk about that a little bit for the next, I don't know, 20 minutes or so, and then we'll do some Q&A and some discussion, and then we'll leave. Okay? So this is not new, this sort of digital niche construction. Those of you who might be tweeting right now using the facsimile of a QWERTY keyboard may not know that the first typewriter was invented by a man named Pellegrino Turi, and he invented it because he was in love. The things we do for love. He was in love with a blind countess, and he said, "Countess, it'd be wonderful if you would write me love letters." And she said, "Pelle, I'd love to help you, but, you know, not going to work." And so he invented a machine to enable that to happen. He invented the first typewriter, which is right there. Those of you who are listening to an MP3 player, right, listen to an iPod, that is manifestation of the CD-ROM or the CD player. And then you had the vinyl record, if you can remember that. And way before that was the Readaphonic Talking Book, which is invented so that blind people could read books again in the early 20th century. Some newer examples. Have you heard of VizWiz? You guys know about VizWiz? It's very cool. It's an app. Now, blind people are amazingly adaptable to their home surroundings, and if you kind of visit someone in their home, it's really curious how they kind of arrange things and objects according to meet their needs. But there's still the issue of finding things in your pantry, because cans are flat things, and usually the label's not Braille, so you don't know if you're picking up a can of Goya beans versus Campbell's soup versus, you know, cat food, you know, right? So what they've invented in University of Rochester is this tool that allows people who are blind to take a photo of something, send it up into the cloud, or clouds, as was mentioned in this morning's keynote, right? And then a trusted network of sighted users send data back to the phone saying, "Hey, your oven is set at 425, that's a can of beans, that's a $20 bill, right? And it's a really interesting sort of crowd sourcing type thing, which I find really interesting. A better story comes from the UK. 2-year-old Iris Donnelly was on holiday with her parents, and she was struck by a brain tumor and had to undergo emergency surgery and then 8 months of radiation therapy. And during that time, she did recover, but she had trouble relearning the ABCs. And her father, Sean Donnelly, was having frustration trying to get her to adapt to pencil and paper again. She just had a real hard time with writing, right? But he thought, you know, I want her to be able to at least start to learn the alphabet all over. However, she loved tracing things on the iPad, and he thought, well, gosh, maybe I can make that, maybe there's an app that exists. Well, it didn't exist. So he worked with a firm and had one built, and it's called Share My ABCs. And as you see from the video here, what she does is trace these letters, associates them with words such as B for bird. She is now today a reasonably healthy 5-year-old, given her situation, and she's now able to handwrite letters to her relatives, which are sent via email. The Share My ABCs app has now been translated in, I think, 8 languages and is being used in special education programs all around the world, with Mr. Donnelly getting 25% of royalties. It's a nice story. Here's another nice story. This is my friend Lisa Domacamp from County Wicklow in Ireland, outside of Dublin. That's her daughter Grace, who is now 13 years old. I don't know how many of you have experience working with people who have autism or on a spectrum disorder. And those who are severely autistic, like Grace, sometimes have tantrums. And people think, well, that's the disorder, that's the autism doing the tantrum. And it usually isn't. It's usually a matter of frustration. The frustration of not being able to communicate or to be understood or a number of things. And Lisa has told me that you can always tell the mother of an autistic kid because she has 2 black eyes and bite marks all over her arms. Now, what parents sometimes do for their children is create large binders of photos. Because if you don't know what your child wants, the likelihood that frustration and subsequent tantrum goes up. So if you have a photo for a Coke, you have a photo for a lavatory, a photo for, you know, things the child wants. But the problem is that when you get to be about Grace's age, those binders get really thick, and you wind up taking multiple backpacks with you everywhere. And the likelihood is there's going to be something in that binder that the child wants, and you're not going to be able to identify it. And this happened to Lisa once, where Grace had a complete meltdown in the middle of a department store. And some of you may know the feeling. And, you know, after she sort of got that calmed down, she went outside and she looked across the street and she saw a bus with an advertisement for the iPhone. And she said, wait a second. That thing holds photos. It has a camera. What the hell am I doing carrying around all these stupid binders? So she worked with a freelance Silicon Valley developer and built the Grace app for iPhone and iPad, which is in use today. Now, this is an interesting little, you know, kind of design modality, because we had this idea that, like, we're going to make an app, and we just kind of put the app there, and everything's perfect. And that's not really how it works. In this case, anyone who comes in contact with the child's life, whether it be a caseworker or a teacher or a caregiver, they sign a literal contract, literally a contract, saying that you're going to use this app to take advantage of teachable moments, right? So it's not just knowing what to ask for. It's also about knowing how and when to ask for it, right? It helps the continuum of the child's care. Okay. One final example. I feel like I've been talking too much, so I want to show you a little video here. This is a stand-up comedian in the UK with cerebral palsy who uses an app to do his act. So I've got a little 2-minute video here about this, and so I will play it up for you now.
Simply walking down the street is a challenge for Lee Ridley. He's lived with cerebral palsy since birth and is unable to speak. He uses a voice synthesizer to communicate. But Lee has learned to laugh in the face of adversity, and he's making other people chuckle along with him. He's taken to stand-up comedy, performing as Lost Voice Guy. And tonight's a big night. It's his first paid booking, and he's playing to a packed house in the British capital.
Thank you for that lovely welcome. I haven't felt this important since the doctors said I was going to be a special child.
When I realized I'd never be able to talk again, I was speechless. People have often asked me why I wanted to put myself in a position where everyone can stare and laugh at me. The truth is that it happens to me every day anyway. At least this way, there's a scheduled time and place for it. I am not related to Stephen Hawking in any way. However, I do hate the way people take the of the way he speaks. I can really synthesize with him. I hope you enjoy the rest of your night. Goodbye.
I've always believed that any subject can be joked about if handled correctly. I think I can get away with more because it's essentially about me. I'd like to think the audience go away with a more positive view on disability.
Okay. Good so far? Everybody feel okay? Okay, all right. If you ever go to Toronto, stop by the Bloorview Highland Rehabilitation Hospital for Kids. Go to the fourth floor and look for Dr. Tom Chow. Tell him I sent you. He'll say who or something, so no, but he knows me. And they have actually taken some of what I just described and applied it to a real-world setting. And, you know, all these things are great, these sort of pie-in-the-sky theoretical ideas, but I like to see where does it live in the real world. And this is happening right now in this hospital on behalf of kids who cannot communicate because of their disabilities. Now, when you go to the fourth floor, it's interesting. Like most doctor hospital waiting rooms, you've got People magazine and bad art and things like that. And there's nothing like that here. Instead, there's a carpet. And as you walk on the carpet, there's a huge screen on the wall, probably about maybe five of those panels of that wall there. And it forms designs on the wall, which is interesting. And as you step on something firmer, there's more designs. And if you stand there for a long time, there's even more designs. I remember watching that and thinking about, remember that commercial in the 80s, the I fall and I can't get up? Remember that? The panic button? You know, people have never really thought about this, that the panic button doesn't work if the person's unconscious, right? So I thought, like, now you're seeing this, and you see smart carpets, and what they're starting to do now is create carpets in people's homes that if you happen to fall and you go unconscious, the carpet can measure that, hey, there's a humanoid-sized shape here that hasn't moved in about 10 minutes. Maybe I should send a note off to the first responder, right? And we're seeing this now take place in the residential homes and long-term care facilities. Really fascinating. Dr. Chow's group is doing all these really interesting prototypes. The favorite one I like is something called the Hummer. I'm going to talk over this a little bit while it's playing. So the way it works is, for a child who doesn't have the use of her arms or her hands, it's kind of a choker that goes on top of the larynx. And there's a little mechanism that sits here. And all you have to do is grunt. You just go, like that. And what it does is toggle through the buttons on an app, not unlike what Grace had for autism. So you can see, so what it's doing is indicating, I want to do this, I want to do that. And you kind of toggle through, which is really fascinating. It's a little cumbersome, but for someone who hasn't spoken in 16 years, you can see how this might be a really huge breakthrough for somebody. Need just one more here.
I want. I want to go to my room.
So, whenever I speak someplace, I like to do a kind of a local shout out. So at the Maryland Institute College of Art, which is up the street here, up North Charles, from where I graduated many, many, many years ago, 20 plus or so, they're doing a thing now with fiber where they're embedding computers into clothes. And we've read about this a lot, where sensors are going into things that we actually wear, which is really interesting kind of space, so that now almost anything is a computer, which is interesting. And this has been tested by a guy in Bangladesh named Anirudh Sharma. And he developed something called Lashao, which is a sneaker with an Arduino lily pad in the heel and vibrating sensors on the toe, on the sides, on the back. And the way this works is someone who is blind simply walks, and these vibrating sensors pick up that there's an obstruction, and so you know to pivot and to turn and to walk around. And people are actually using this today and walking without canes, walking without guide dogs, with some degree of success. And I look at that and I think, that's interesting stuff, but how can we apply that to something like, almost like ghetto electronics? Can we like get that whole spirit of niche construction together and actually just create something in the lab and just see if it works? So I want to show you something here, if you can see it. This is called an a cappella, this green thing here. It's a prescribed medical device for people with COPD, in other words, bronchial asthma and other related respiratory problems. There's a mouthpiece here that you blow into, and on the back side here is sort of a propeller. And the way it's supposed to work is you blow into it, you kind of go like that. And then this starts to go like that. And it sends a vibration into the lungs, which loosens up the, you know, crud that's in the lungs, and then you go expel it someplace else. And we thought, if I was an adult, I'm an adult sometimes, but if I was, it's like, and they said, here, I'm your doctor, do this 3 times a day for your condition. You know, I might do it or I might not, and the onus is really on me. But if you try to have a child do this, you might get a very quizzical or confused response, like, what am I doing with this again? Why am I doing that? So we thought maybe there's a way we can sort of create a little bit more incentive for someone who needs to do this treatment but doesn't understand the value of it quite yet. So we kind of did this thing with really, I mean, anybody in this room could do this, simple Radio Shack electronics to see how it would work. And this is what we came up with. Now, I want you to pay very close attention to
the body. Go ahead, blow into it.
Watch her body language as she's sitting.
Try and do it slowly so it goes down. It opens slowly. Nice, like that.
Watch how she sits up a little straighter now. She's doing it properly. A little more engaged. Simple test, but you know, sometimes the simple tests get you to a certain point, right? So we're still working on that. Now, if you're ever in Philadelphia and you're riding the subway or the regional trains, you may see these strange billboards they have, right? And these billboards have food products, groceries, right there, right? With these strange barcodes, and the idea is that you go up with your phone and you take a scan of it, and then you sort of capture this in the phone and you send that message to Peapod, which is a function of Giant, and a truck comes by and drops off all the groceries to your house, which is wonderful, right? Here's the problem, though. If you're blind, that's just another obstruction in your way, right? I have no idea that that works. I have no idea that could work. And it's like one of those other areas of inclusion. And I'm kind of working on a solution for this right now, but I bring that up because I'm reminded of something that my friend Carl Groves told me several months ago, and I haven't gotten out of my mind since, when he said, you know, accessibility, we talk about web accessibility and technical accessibility and all this stuff, but it's really about providing fundamental human services, right, to benefit more people in more situations. And we look at that and we start thinking about, like, what is it mean to be human, right? Of course, it means to stuff something in your mouth so you stay alive, but there's also the element of understanding what makes us inherently human, and part of that is the need to connect with other people with our talents and our desires. And, you know, essentially that muse, that part that makes us, it's kind of like a little internal renaissance, right? Part of it is like celebrating our life on this planet. And with that in mind, I want to introduce you to someone I know by the name of Mason Ellsworth, who lives in West Virginia. He is 22 years old now. At the age of 18, he was a music prodigy. He could play 6 instruments fluently. He could sing. He held the first chair bassoon role in his local orchestra. And he was all set to go to college on a full music scholarship. In July of 2008, his car was hit by a truck on a rainy night. He was transported by helicopter to Baltimore Mercy Medical Center, right here, right up the street on St. Paul. He went into a coma for 7 months with what they call a TBI, a traumatic brain injury, suffered contraction in both knees, and eventually did return, which surprised a lot of physicians, quite honestly. Didn't surprise his parents, who have stayed very faithful all along to his development. And I was introduced to him in December of 2011. And when I first met him, he had no use of his hands, really couldn't talk, very cognitive aware, knew what was going on, and could kind of go, just a little bit. Now, as a former art school graduate, there's nothing I hate more than lost creative potential. It just bugs me. And I got the sense that maybe there's a muse here to be captured. Incidentally, he's posing in front of his own painting, which he created last year. He's pointing at the wrong one because he's a joker, but that's his sense of humor. But when I first met him, I was kind of thinking, like, well, maybe, you know, I'd been reading about there's these apps are developing now for kids in special education programs who kind of teach them how to play musical instruments, and there's like big pianos you can use. And I knew about these Smule apps, which are really simple apps for the iPhone and the iPad that essentially can turn almost anyone into a musician as long as you had the ability to blow into the microphone hole or just touch the screen. So we thought maybe give that a go. Maybe we'll see if that can work. So the one we tried was called Ocarina. And Ocarina is very simple. You're probably familiar with it. You literally blow into the microphone and it makes a tone. It goes boo. And then little dots show up on the screen and you tap the dots and it goes boo, goo, goo, goo. And you can play the little songs. And what's interesting about this is that if someone else is connected to the network and using the app at the same time, you can play along with other people at the same time, which is fascinating because he's a gregarious guy, and he's flirting with the nurses, as they tend to do. I mean, he's 22. What do you think is going to happen? And I don't want to portray it like this little thing, like this great discovery, because he still struggles quite a bit. He has an amazing social network around him. And I don't mean Facebook. I mean like real people, like, you know, living nearby. But it was fascinating. It kind of did bring about this sort of renaissance. And I remember his mother telling me once, I want my son to be a productive taxpayer. And if he can do that through his talents, all the better. If there's a way we can do that, then terrific. And now he is starting to do that a little bit. And more importantly, these activities are operating as positive reinforcers for his rehab. Anyone here ever gone through like a physical rehab, like a really painful one? Ever? Anyone? No? You ever seen one? You ever witnessed one? Yeah. I sat in a couple of his, and I winced. I could just tell he was having no fun whatsoever during that situation. But he sticks with it because he knows that it's coming with this other activity that goes along with it. And as they move in parallel, he starts to kind of increase in fidelity. So the family have been really nice in letting me tell this story. They don't have to do that, but they do. And I want to show you this video. Keep in mind that when you watch this young man, 8 months previous, had no use of his hands and couldn't talk. And then soon he was doing this.
There you go. Hey. Yeah. See. Yeah.
Okay, it's short. Okay, one last thing. So, not everyone is like us. And when I say not like us, means that not everyone embraces this technological Internet of Things landscape. You know, there are thoughts that maybe it's getting a little out of control. Maybe that all these new forms of interface design and these new modalities are eventually going to overtake us in many ways, and we'll sort of forget where we end and start, if that makes any sense. And I'll give you two examples. And not that robots are going to chase us around in an infinite loop either, but it's, you know, I worry about that as well, because I'm a worrisome guy. So have you heard about these things, these electrocardiographic implants? You all get that? Electrocardiographic implant, EEG in other words. They figured out a way that you can implant these brass sensors into the brain so that when you're sitting there, you're thinking, okay, I want to move my arm. Now, the white matter of your brain is discharging ions when that happens. And those ions go into a packet, which goes into the arm, which makes the arm move because you've just thought that you need to do this. And what's been discovered is that when these ions are discharged, they can be intercepted by pieces of brass embedded on the skull or put on top. And by intercepting those, they found out that you can control digital objects on a screen. So now they have these video games where all you have to do is think about a spaceship moving across, and it works. I mean, you look at that and you think, that is, wow, to the point where like you can just take something and quite literally plug it into your head and affect change in a digital environment. You might think that's crazy until you consider that, I think about maybe a year and a half ago, a woman took a drink unassisted for the first time in 17 years using a cybernetic body part that she activated with her mind, right? For the first time in close to 2 decades. Taking a drink by herself. So once again, it's context of use that provides a little bit of sort of clarity to this. Here's another example. Heard about Simon? You guys know about Simon, the social robot? Social robots are robots that respond to the human condition. And they're considering using these robots in long-term care facilities to look after people who have disabilities and people who are aging. And I mean, my first thought was, there's no way I want that thing near me when I'm 90 years old and probably senile and, you know, reliving parts of my past because it's so creepy. But it took an op-ed piece in the New York Times written by someone with a disability who actually said, and this is a direct quote, if someone can help nursing home staff clean my backside, I'm not going to complain. That's a good thing as far as I'm concerned. Right? And, you know, we're entering this weird world now. I mean, it's been alluded to already today where, like, you know, the idea of, like, where computers begin and end. Everything's a computer, but nothing is a computer, right? You know what I mean? It's like, it's all digital, but it's not digital because it's part of us. The body is an interface. The stuff around us is an interface. And I think, like, do we have enough of the basics down? Are we moving all that too fast and leaving too many people behind, and is that gap starting to widen more and more and more? So I want to read you a little something here by a guy named Michael Graves, who is a former architect and a current painter. And this could happen to any of us, right? He got a sinus infection when he was 68 years old, and he is now paraplegic as a result of that sinus infection. And he wrote a little bit here, which I'm going to read to you verbatim, about the first day he became aware of his disability and how he'd have to deal with it. So he says, "Early on, my first day out of bed at Kessler Hospital, I went into the bathroom in my wheelchair to shave. I looked in the mirror, and the bottom of it was at the height of my forehead. I couldn't see my face, so there was no shaving with a straight razor. An electric razor was brought to me, and I tried to plug it in, and it was out of reach. And I thought, well, at least I can wash my face, but I couldn't reach the faucet. So the next day, my surgeon came by. I asked him to get in my wheelchair. I strapped him in, and he couldn't reach anything. I asked, who designed this? He said, experts. One in seven of us has a disability right now, some form or another, in this planet. That's 15% of the world's population. And that number is going to go up. And when I look at this, I think about my grandmother. I worry about my grandmother. I think about Alice Cooper. I worry about him. For a lot of reasons, perhaps. But I'm also worried about us. I'm worried about you, and I'm worried about me. And I'm in a situation now where, you know, I'm getting to that age where maybe I'm relying on this stuff, and I'm a little afraid that this stuff is moving a little too fast and we're not taking advantage of the people who really could benefit the most. In short, I think that we could all become digital outcasts. It's not solely about the accessibility of iPad apps and devices and websites. It's about the Internet of Things and ensuring that we've taken into account these disenfranchised populations, right? So, and I haven't heard a lot of that today, a little bit, but not a lot. So I'm going to give you four things I'd like you to please remember. That's okay, all right? Just four, and then we're done. Number one, the idea of competence. We sometimes have this idea that people have a disability or they don't. You know, they're injured or they're not, they're sick or they're not. It's very binary. That's not the way biology works. It's not the way science works. It doesn't work that way. We're all good at some things. We're not good at others. And the way we adapt to the environment or our situation determines our competence. This is a kind of a Thomas Armstrong idea, again, which is, you know, we need diversity in the physical and neurological realm because this helps us grow as a human ecosystem. Okay? Second one, affordance. Andrew Hinton said something really interesting today, and really good, I think, where he said, you know, affordance is about ensuring that the tools we use almost become extensions of our bodies. And he used the idea of, like, you pick up a stone, the stone becomes an extension of the body. So there's a certain affordance that's applied to that. Same thing here. When we interact with an object, whether it's an app, you know, small apps work very well because it's very simple. Le Chow works very nicely. It's a shoe. You just put it on, okay? You know, and if it's clear how we interact with it, right, it makes it a better product in many ways. And keep in mind that people who have a disability are probably missing multiple senses, so that affordance becomes doubly important, if not more. Third, incentives. I am not using the G word. I refuse. You know, the game word. I hate that word. Yeah, and I'm not talking about just incentives to play games, but also the incentive to surpass a level. If you use workplace software, what are you trying to do? You just want to get something done, right? If you want to go on a website to make a deposit, right, you just want to do that. You just want to go to a banking site and get your stuff done. That's about achieving different levels. It's not always about playing a game. So when Mason is doing his rehab, you know, he's trying to achieve a better level. He's trying to get to that. His mother's convinced that he will walk someday. I don't know how he's going to do it. He has no knees. But he might, you know? And the fact that he knows that he might provides that incentive. And finally, I think most importantly, empathy, right? I define empathy as allowing for attributes that cannot be changed. And maybe they could if they wanted to, but sometimes they can't. So, that's it, four things. And we'll see this as we continue to move forward. And it doesn't matter what kind of technology we're talking about, whether we're talking about the first prosthetic hand developed in Paris in the early 20th century, or that secret weird science fiction future when, you know, babies are born with the technology already infused. You know, that world is now upon us. It is here. It's a part of us, right? And I'm going to leave you with this almost obligatory William Gibson quote, because let's face it, you know, I can't talk about this without mentioning William Gibson, and which is that the future's already arrived. It's just not evenly distributed as yet. But we're working on it, and so are you, and I want to thank you for that. So I want to take your questions. I've been talking too much, and I think there's a microphone right here someplace. Before I do that, if you're interested in this at all, little play. I do have a book coming out about this. It's called Digital Outcasts, Moving Technology Forward Without Leaving People Behind. It'll be published by Morgan Kaufman in about 10 days, in fact. Otherwise, you can reach me. My name's Kel Smith, K-E-L, and my company's called Anikto, A-N-I-K-T-O. It's the Greek word for open. And I'm done talking, so go ahead, please. Tell me your story.
Hi. I was wondering if you're aware of any work done with people with Alzheimer's or dementia with this type of technology.
Yes. In fact, I'm a student mentor at School of Visual Arts in New York, and my student is actually developing something very much like what you're talking about for older folks who have dementia. It's sort of an app learning platform, and the way it works is it recalls elements from the person's life previously, and it sort of captures that moment, and then it allows you to take advantage of that time together. And I remember when my grandfather had Alzheimer's, he was an architect, and he would just kind of sit and feel like a piece of furniture for the most part, because everyone just talked around him and, you know, kind of just, oh, excuse me, Grandpa. You know, but I found that if you could bring up something from his past, like a building that he designed or something, you caught that little spark, right? And he was able to, like, just go off for, like, 20 minutes. And, like, you know, so you got to share that moment a little bit. So the student I'm working with is actually developing something just like that, and she's looking to sell that into long-term care facilities. And I'm sure there are other examples, but it's a great question because it's a really interesting area. And it's one that I think is going to grow in proportion, especially with some of the things going on with the government now, with Project Blue Button and what they're doing with the VA. And you'll see a lot of this stuff start to rise up a bit. Thank you.
Hey, thanks, Cal. Hi. I was just wondering, when there are so many things to change, especially in larger organizations, to make things more accessible for people, where do you start and how do you sort of scale or integrate accessibility?
Well, great question. Well, the short answer is the earlier the better, right, in terms of when you start. But where do you start? That is a challenge that varies from organization to organization. So what I try to do is integrate it in the product development space first. The one thing that you don't do is just walk in there saying, you're going to get sued. Because it's not true, usually, right? It's not nice. And nobody wants to be told that something they spent 3 years of their life working on is now completely crap because it doesn't meet some criteria that they were really unaware, right? So depending on the size of the organization, that's a tougher. And I think I know why you're asking too, by the way. So larger organizations, you kind of find your priority levels, right? You find the areas of most pain and the areas where the most people are using it and having the most pain, as opposed to making a checklist and saying we have to do like these 1,000 things. So that's my short, bad answer to what is probably a whole other presentation, a whole other discussion. So, you know, in terms of integrating these kinds of thoughts and activities into the product development cycle, I try to align accessibility as a form of innovation and cite some of these examples, right? Nobody wants to make a product that people don't use. I'm sure there are people who do, but that's strange to me, right? So the more you can widen that, and if you can come back with data, it helps a lot. So that's a bad answer to your question, I'm sorry. So, but we'll talk later. Questions? Comments? Threats? All right. Hey, Dave.
Thanks, Kel. When I hear you talking about some of this stuff, I think of the word hack.
Yeah.
To hack something, but a hack is very different than a bird building a nest.
Yeah.
So I don't feel comfortable calling it a hack. I mean, what is that activity?
Yeah.
It's
remaking.
It's resourceful.
I agree with you. I don't love the word hack to this because you're not really hacking. I mean, you are. You're taking something that already exists and maybe breaking it out, but you're creating something new from that. I think of it more like remaking. I think that you're kind of building something else from something that already existed, right? I like the term niche construction because I think that's really accurate. I think that's really what you're doing is developing some solution that's very customized to you. And there's many of these out there. I mean, I was reading in Philadelphia, there was a woman who had a cane. And if you've ever kind of watched someone who's blind who has a cane and they kind of walk around, it's very good at detecting things on the floor, but something that's like waist high, like say a velvet rope in a bank. I mean, I've seen people nearly topple themselves and crack their skull on these things or on turnstiles like in subway stations. So the University of Penn outfit on her cane, a sensor which picked up things, really tiny little sensor, $30 box of electronics sitting right on top of, in the middle of a cane. You know, is that a hack? I don't know. It's a remaking of something. Could that be made smaller with a better form factor and commercialized to the AT market? Absolutely. Should it? Yeah. I don't know. I hope so. Okay. Well, If you want to talk to me, you know where I am.
The IA Summit podcast is sponsored by the UIE Virtual Seminar Program, with scores of online seminars your team can access on demand. For free access to a virtual seminar, visit uie.com/IAS13. And you can find the rest of the IA Summit podcast at library.iasummit.org.